Welcome, all of you. I'm Jonathan Leap, Director of CREFSA here at the LSE. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to this evening's debate, which, as you know, is about South Africa as a possible model, or not, for resolution of the crisis in the Middle East. We have a very distinguished panel this evening. But before I introduce them, I want to say something by way of background, both about the debate, but particularly also about things here at the LSE. As you all know, profound changes took place in Africa in the 1990s and throughout the developing world. And not least, and perhaps most far-reaching of these, was the change in South Africa, the political transformation that occurred there. This transformation has been already the subject of a rich and extensive literature. And we're very privileged tonight because the imprint of the contributions made by our three speakers this evening are still very apparent in the literature as it has evolved over the past 10 years. Africa changed a lot in the 1990s, but LSE's involvement in Africa also changed a lot in the 1990s. The year 1990 saw the founding at the LSE of two new research centers, CREFSA, the center with which I'm involved, the Center for Research into Economics and Finance in Southern Africa, and DESTIN, the Development Studies Institute, were both founded in that year, 1990. CREFSA was an initiative of the Commonwealth Heads of Government and was set up to help assist on the level of research and the intellectual debate, the transition that was already underway in South Africa, and has evolved into a research institution that focuses not only on South Africa, but more broadly on the region, and looks at questions such as the potential for regional economic integration, the role of regulation and financial stability in an environment with increasingly volatile cross-border capital flows, and the role of the financial system in serving the needs of developing countries, the role of microfinance as well as of more developed institutions. DESTIN, the Development Studies Institute, was set up as a focal point for teaching on development issues at the school and has become in the process of a source of much research as well, not only in Africa, but in the Middle East and throughout the developing world. Particularly with respect to tonight's debate, particularly important was the founding in May 2001, under the leadership of Dr. James Putzel, of the new Crisis States research program here at the school. And the Crisis States program has both research in Africa and in the Middle East and elsewhere throughout the developing world. And a large number of researchers in many different disciplines have been involved in that project. Before turning to the speakers, I'd like to invite all of you to join us for the reception that's being held after this evening's debate. It'll be commencing as soon as the debate finishes, and it'll be held on the fifth floor of this building. So if you go in, if the lifts are working, otherwise the stairs to the fifth floor in the senior dining room, and we'd love to have you join us if you can. Well, as I said, we have a very distinguished group of speakers tonight, and it's a privilege to share the platform with them. I might say on a personal level that before opting, I think maybe to some inexplicably, to become an economist, I was actually trained as a historian. And I was influenced early on by the contributions of an American historian, Bernard Bailyn, who argued, among others, other historians, that in addition to the undeniably important influence of social, economic, and political factors on change, that intellectual origins, in his case of the American Revolution, were important too. I think while none of our speakers on the platform this evening would claim the front stage in the South African transition, all of them have influenced, and sometimes profoundly, the intellectual discourse that accompanied, that helped all of us to understand, and that sometimes drove the transition process in South Africa. All three of the individuals we have with us this evening have been participant observers in the transition process in South Africa, both very actively engaged in trying to understand, but sometimes also pushing the process of change in South Africa. Our main speaker this evening, Professor Herbert Adam, is a political sociologist at Simon Fraser University. Ironically, I first met Professor Adam 20 years ago, almost to the day, today, when he participated in a workshop in the United States, in Pennsylvania, on the potential role of sanctions and other things, such as the Sullivan Principles, Codes of Conduct, on the transition, which of course at that point was in very, very early stages in South Africa. He has, since the 1970s, contributed enormously to our understandings, not only of the political elements that influence the change, but of the very complex sociological phenomenon that drive those political features. Our first discussant is Professor Colin Bundy, who is currently principal and director of SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, a post he took up in May 2001. Before that, he was principal of Wits University, vice chancellor of Wits University in South Africa, before that has had a very distinguished career through the starting back in the 1970s as a historian who helped to redefine our understanding of South African history, and in that way had an important influence on our understanding of the transformation process as well. Our second discussant is Dr. Wilmot James. He's the executive director of the Human Sciences Research Council in South Africa, formerly dean of the humanities faculty at University of Cape Town, and also a member of the board of the Ford Foundation. Dr. James, too, has been a participant observer, actively engaged in the transformation process as head of the Institute for Democracy of South Africa, KIDASA, for 5 years, and also as a contributor of numerous studies of racism and other aspects relating to the transition process in South Africa. So without any further ado, it's my pleasure to announce our main speaker this evening, Professor Herbert Adam.
Thank you. I don't have to tell you that we are discussing one of the most, in the comparison of Israel and South Africa, one of the most sensitive topics, almost an emotional minefield, particularly for someone with a German accent. So let me first say I'm humbled by so many people coming and discussing that issue, and particularly by some colleagues from whom I learned a lot, Ephraim Nimni, Avishai Ehrlich, my colleagues on the platform, Wilmot James, with whom I have a long friendship, and many others. About 10 days ago, the Harvard University president made a remark which caused an uproar in America in response to faculties and students' drive for disinvestment. He spoke of a soft anti-Semitism. And in response, sort of letter pages of the New York Times had arguments for and against this remark, and one of his colleagues actually said, any comparison between South Africa and Israel is implicit anti-Semitism. I would say this is nonsense, and while I am conscious of this suspicion and of the charge of anti-Semitism, one has to distinguish a critique of Israel's policy from the kind of collective condemnation of a group which fits that label. And I think particularly tonight we don't, at least I don't want to discuss in detail whether Israel resembles apartheid, or we can do that later, but I'm interested in a different topic, namely what can we learn from the South African negotiated settlement. Is it possible to replicate it in the Middle East, as some people argue? Would the same techniques work in the Middle East, as Bishop Tutu recently said, if there were disinvestment and sanctions, Israel would go the same route as white South Africa? This raises a difficult issue of the relationship between nationalism and racism, I don't think they are the same. Nationalism is far more respectable and acceptable than racism. Israel enjoys much greater legitimacy than apartheid South Africa ever had. In fact, the apartheid apologies tried to shift the rationalizations of apartheid already in the 70s into a kind of ethnic cultural discourse of preserving ethnic identity rather than white privilege. But I do think that the consequences of nationalism and racism often resemble each other. You can go through the whole list of homogenizing the other, of making the other invisible in Israel. Israelis generally don't even speak of Palestinians, they lump them together as Arabs. And there's sort of a background phenomenon. At a recent conference at Columbia, my overriding impression was there was a South African envy almost. People asked what can South Africa teach the world? And if you ask that question, I think there's one thing which stuck out, and that is this Freedom Charter stipulation that South Africa belongs to all of those who live in it. In other words, citizenship as a common denominator transcends ethnicity. In a way, it was a victory of Kant over Herder, while in Israel and Palestine, Herder is still dominant over Kant. South Africa as a settler society, and we probably will discuss that concept. Many of you have that little paper I wrote. South Africa as a settler society is almost also unique and different in as far as here we have a settler group which gave up power without being defeated. They negotiated themselves out of power, which is unique. I don't think the armed struggle in South Africa was ever the center of that attempt. It was much more armed propaganda, and many ANC leaders never believed that they would enter Pretoria at the top of a column of insurgents. Also, we should remind ourselves, as far as the whites were concerned, it was a democracy. It was an ethnic democracy, like Israel is an ethnic democracy. That term is also highly controversial. But that ethnic democracy then became an object of desire for those excluded. And also it made clear, because it tolerated opposition, that not all of those who were part of the dominant group supported that system. And it blocked the kind of collective demonization of the other. And finally, I think what helped it a lot was the Afrikaners considered themselves natives. They didn't engage in the sort of racialization of minority protection as the whites did in Rhodesia, where they, I think, had a 20% minority clause in parliament, which set them up as a different group. When they negotiated themselves out of power, they realized it would be black majority rule, or as it is euphemistically called, non-racial democracy. So what lessons can be drawn? What can we learn from this for the Middle East? And in that little paper, I look at six issues: economic interdependence, religion, third-party intervention, the international context, fourth, leadership, fifth, political culture, and lastly, violence. Let me perhaps summarize briefly the major thesis in the six realms, then look at what is the sort of outlook, the forecast for the Middle East in light of this. And perhaps then, towards the end, add some of the lessons we can draw from that negotiated settlement. If someone says this negotiated settlement can be replicated in the Middle East, or can it be replicated, someone said, can the miracle be replicated? Clearly the answer is no. Nor was it a miracle in South Africa. A miracle is depends on divine intervention. It's a mystical term and is not good for analysis. Also, a lot of titles use miracle as a metaphor. Economic interdependence. Clearly, the crucial issue of difference in South Africa. Here we had an economy where the profits of the minority depended on the labor of the majority, and also the majority was dependent on having a job based on a semi-industrial or industrializing economy. Above all, since the mid-70s, this interdependent economy, where political organizations were banned, experienced strikes which were criminal and outlawed, and despite the criminalization of strikes, they took place. And in response to the Natal strikes, more sophisticated capital realized it had to allow workers' organizations, it had to allow unions with which it could negotiate. In other words, a leaderless mass of people was a threat to stability, and it was essential to legalize unions. Legal unions became the most important platform for organization and for resistance in the absence of banned political movements. Legalized unions used strikes, consumer boycotts, and other forms of industrial action to advance their cause. In Israel-Palestine, this situation is different, particularly now with closure, where actually the Palestinian labor in Israel has been more or less replaced by foreign guest workers from the Balkans and from the Philippines. In Israel-Palestine, we have two economies side by side, and the major victims of these closures are the Palestinians. So we have great asymmetry in this area. We also, talking about asymmetry, and this is absolutely crucial here, is the demography. I don't believe in Kant's statement that demography is destiny, but clearly South African whites could never contemplate to get rid of the black majority. The number of whites in South Africa dropped from 20% to, what is it now, 11 or 12%. And I asked once F.W. de Klerk what actually triggered him to change his outlook. And one of the first things he mentioned was this demographic inevitable change. He said, you must negotiate, or he used the word, you must settle before you have to settle. In other words, while you are still in a relatively favorable position, then make a settlement rather than wait until you are further weakened. And the weakening aspect was the demographic aspect. In Israel, if you want to put it in a crude term, it is about land. In South Africa, the conflict is about labor, or was mainly about labor. We can explore that in more details later. Let me come to the second aspect, namely religion. I don't argue that the Israel-Palestine conflict is a religious conflict, but both sides use religion to mobilize their constituency. Furthermore, as you well know, the land is imbued with sacred places. It is ancestral ground and sacred for both Jews and Palestinians, mythical, cherished landmarks to which people attach a meaning which didn't exist in South Africa. In South Africa, religion functioned as a point of commonality. In the end, even the Calvinists came around after a long agonizing debate to declare apartheid a sin and heresy. But the other main churches already were in the forefront of delegitimizing and assailing apartheid. This is not the case in Israel-Palestine. Even during the ethnic cleansing of the Group Areas Act, the bulldozers left the mosques and Hindu temples in Cato Manor or in District 6 standing. It almost sounds like I exonerate here apartheid, and this is not my intention. I want to point to the differences. South Africa has no Jerusalem, where both sides claim sovereignty. Also, Jerusalem is not the main contentious issue. I think in Israel and Palestine, the refugee issue is much more intractable than Jerusalem. But even in Jerusalem, archaeology is politicized. Netanyahu declared the opening of the tunnels the bedrock of Jewish existence. And the orthodoxy of the 20% minority of strong believers, and particularly some of the settlers, is quite different from the right-wing interest in South Africa in autonomy and in territorial autonomy and self-determination. And above all, when you perceive a conflict in religious terms, in religious absolutes, it doesn't become bargainable and negotiable. Both sides confront each other with this perception of absolutes, and we can call it irrational or mythical or whatever. But if people believe in it, it is real, and we have to take that seriously. Third party intervention, I don't have to tell you that the obvious. South Africa had a hostile diaspora. Israel has a supportive diaspora. I think particularly in North America, the overwhelming majority of Jewish people, and about slightly more than 40% live in the diaspora, share the belief in the need for a Jewish state, a sanctuary, a homeland, and regardless of the policy would support it. The apartheid state, as I mentioned earlier, was a pariah state. It continued to trade with the Western world, but the trade and the economic relationship had to be concealed. There's nothing of this kind of concealment in the American support, in the unconditional support of Israel. I would argue also that this creates a kind of, let me put it this way, in South Africa we had a clear certainty about the eventual victory of the just cause. When that would take place was open, but it was without doubt, particularly for the disenfranchised, that they would be victorious. I'm not sure that Palestinians can argue that case with this certainty. As I will argue later, there is great uncertainty about what will be the eventual outcome of the Middle East conflict. It can range from expulsion to subjugation, ghettoization, to two states, to ideally almost naively, optimistically, a one-state multicultural democracy. But this uncertainty weakens resistance, while in South Africa this was not the case. I would argue that the optimism that sanctions brought that system down is a sort of mythology which developed afterwards. Sanctions were important to facilitate change. It was important, the moral ostracism was important. But sanctions, we have to differentiate here between trade sanctions, which many South African business dismissed as basically just an additional tax, and we have to distinguish the disinvestment campaign, which actually benefited South African capital at the beginning because it allowed it to buy up the foreign companies at bargain prices. We have to distinguish the inability to get access to investments, to capital in foreign markets, which did have an impact. And we can perhaps distinguish the cultural boycott, which I think was totally counterproductive. I cannot understand to this day why the British Actors Guild banned progressive plays and other progressive sorts from entering South Africa and played and helped the censor in this regard, rather than influencing a regime and being subversive intellectually. So sanctions in Ottawa and in Melbourne, the bureaucrats perceive that they opened the prison gates of Mandela with sanctions. I think that is an exaggeration. And I don't think, I cannot envisage a situation at the moment where Israel, given that the US bankrolls the costs of Israel, will actually undergo a similar fate as apartheid South Africa. There is also very little of the kind of Western guilt which we see in the Israeli situation. But what we can learn is that the ANC captured world opinion gradually, while the Palestinians, as Edward Said has argued many times, have great difficulties actually putting their cause across, particularly in North America, where the media are more pro-Israel than the Israeli media themselves. Leadership. Clearly, I don't have to engage in the platitude to say that Arafat isn't a Mandela, and Sharon is far from having the vision of a de Klerk. But the leadership in South Africa was much more cohesive, much more legitimate than the fragmented leadership in both on both the Palestinian and the Israeli side. And the leadership is very important in selling a controversial compromise to a skeptical audience. We had in South Africa a similar debate about violence in the exiled movement as we see now in among the Palestinian society. Hani and Schwete wanted to extend the armed struggle into soft targets and actually argued in 88 to, in the interest of freedom, it doesn't matter if the country is made into a wasteland. And Tambo, the ANC president at that time, intervened and said it is not ANC policy to attack civilians. It is not ANC policy to do this. If this happens, it is a byproduct of the struggle, but it is not our intention. In some cases, the ANC even apologized. Leadership in such a situation faces the constant danger of being, of outbidding from extremist factions. In the South African case, the PSC didn't make headways against the ANC, although the PSC had a much more radical program of land redistribution and socialism. The ANC exploited the internal cleavages in the white camp much more successfully than the Palestinians so far have done. They learned the art to address the opponent. I don't think Palestinians have yet to communicate successfully with Israeli opinion. Political culture, my fifth point. What strikes you, anyone who has visited the two societies, was that despite the segregation in apartheid South Africa, there was much more interracial intimacy and personal contact than in Israel or Palestine. I would describe the dominant attitude of Afrikaners towards blacks as paternalism, a condescending paternalism, which isn't equal status contact, but it is something different from the social distance which you have and from the chauvinism which you find in Israel, where even among the left, very little interest or contact exists on the about how the other side argues and lives. That was different in South Africa. What was different in South Africa also was that the Afrikaner-English relations, about 40% of whites are English speakers as opposed to the 60% Afrikaners. The English benefited from Afrikaner rule, voted for it, but they considered the Afrikaner rule basically as foreign. While in Israel, even the left or even the refuseniks of the soldiers who refuse to serve are united in their Zionism, in their willingness to defend Israel proper. They only refuse to do service in the occupied territories. In South Africa, the refuseniks rejected the entire system. In Israel, the issue is really, in the perception of people, just the occupation, or that this is the main issue. So someone says the moral myopia in Israel-Palestine contrasts with the moral erosion, the gradual moral erosion in South Africa. Increasing military power in Israel paradoxically goes together with decreasing personal security. I would even go so far to say that the average Afrikaner in his infantilizing of blacks thought that blacks were on the whole not inclined or even incapable of harming whites. If they did so, the so-called terrorists, they were instigated by communists. But on the whole, they thought there was no inclination of servants to poison the food of whites. What strikes me in Israel on both sides is a tremendous sense of victimhood. Afrikaners were also victims of the earlier Boer War. Quite a high percentage of the Afrikaner population was decimated in so-called concentration camps, but I don't think that can be compared with the Holocaust. And the question really in Israel and Palestine is, can you transcend the notion of victimhood, where you're a prisoner of the past, and where the narcissism of victimization is often used to justify anything? Perhaps one story may illustrate the difference. As left liberal intellectuals, we normally don't deal with the military. We sort of shy away, and when we hear the term military intelligence, we think of oxymorons. I heard that a friend told me that the deputy head of military intelligence under apartheid, a great admirer of Israel, recently went to Israel and came back disillusioned. He said he is now pro-Palestinian. And that really spurred my interest, and I arranged to phone him from Vancouver. I didn't know the man. He runs a restaurant in Pretoria now. And said, would you be prepared to talk, would it be on the record or off the record, about your impression in Israel? He said, sure. And he started off with saying the Israelis do everything wrong in the book. Now, coming from a military intelligence man who worked closely with Israelis, that was very interesting. I said, what do you mean, General? He was actually one of the 22 generals dismissed by de Klerk in 92 as one of those implicated in Third Force activities. And we had a 45-minute conversation, and I remember three main points from his military mind now. He said, we fought a bush war, he says. We fought SWAPO in the bush war. We didn't really fight the ANC. What they do in Palestine, they fight an urban warfare with the army, and you can never train a soldier to act with restraint. They should use the police. We in South Africa, as the military, kept sort of a clean hand. The police almost did the dirty work. That was a similar thing as it is argued in Germany, where the Wehrmacht for a long time had the image of being not involved in atrocities in the occupied territories. Same thing in South Africa. The second point, perhaps more important, he made was, in Israel, they use closure, they use collective punishment. We always made a distinction between good and bad flags. We called it the non-shooting war, the war about the hearts and minds of people, and we realized that 80% was winning politically. In Israel, they alienate everyone. We couldn't afford that. And a third point he made, now compare this point with the recent statement by the Israeli army chief that Palestinians constitute a cancer which has to be cut out. I asked an Israeli colleague once, why don't you adopt, he was a defender of the supporter of Sharon, why don't you adopt the more sophisticated co-optation techniques of the South African army? And he says, first of all, that's very costly. And secondly, you do it only if you have to live with these people. We want to get rid of these people. And that was the honest answer. South Africa couldn't get rid of the black majority. They had to live with it and had to at least cultivate part of the potentially hostile population. And then he made a third point. And I'm not sure how far I can trust him here, whether this is a hindsight rationalization, but it was an intriguing point. He said, while we worked closely with Israeli colleagues during apartheid, they always told us to be more assertive towards blacks. I said, General, what do you mean with more assertive? Well, they said, why don't you take out the terrorists in Soweto? And then we said, we can't do this. These are fellow South Africans. At least there was perhaps a sense of a common fate of some common bonds which is missing in Israel and Palestine, and therefore you have different techniques of domination, and also quite a different setup here with the military, the role of the military in a siege society. Do I have another 5 minutes? Okay. Violence, just quickly. The ANC, I do not remember ever any single case where the liberation forces used suicide as a weapon. Many cases of suicide were presented by the security establishment, many tortured people and assassinated people were presented as suicide cases, but killed by the police, not by the liberation movements. Political assassinations were very similar, including a number of white academics at home and abroad were assassinated, what is in Israel called preventive targeting. And clearly the debate about soft targets and what constitutes terrorism was very similar in South Africa. But I do think, this is now a message, this is a conclusion of despair. What we see in Israel-Palestine is actually the defeat of the Palestinian movement. And we shouldn't kid ourselves about the power differential in that relationship and what that means. How do we get out of this? Can there be negotiations? A few conclusions. There are basically four positions in the Middle East. There is the Islamist extremist position, which still denies the existence of Israel, often propagated abroad in Iran, or which basically says is the very existence of Israel is an insult to the faith, and Israel has to be extinguished, which of course justifies then vigilance on the part of Israel. There is the Jewish extremist position, which mirrors this position, which comes in two versions, namely transfer, ethnic cleansing, or ghettoization. About half of the Israeli population, correct me if I'm wrong, now supports the euphemistically called transfer expulsion. Signs are up in Israel, no Arabs, no terror. And if much predicted Iraqi war starts, that would be the moment a right-wing government waits to put that scenario into place. Ghettoization means, of course, a Bantustan solution, fences, roads only accessible to Israelis and settlers, and you are familiar to this, and I don't have to outline what frustration that means. And the third position is two state positions, which was Oslo, land for peace, which is considered dead now. During the Oslo period, the settlement expanded even under the Labour government of Barak. And this settlement expansion was one way to mollify the right wing. And finally, there is the utopian, attractive solution of a common state, the South African inclusionary solution, a multicultural liberal democracy or a bicommunal state, which would have to be preceded by a redefinition of individual identity on both sides, which the Jewish majority actually considers as a demographic capture and abandonment of the Jewish state. Cultural Judaism would have to be distinguished from political Israeliness. It would be neither a Muslim Palestine nor a Jewish Israel. Both communities could worship their God and speak their language as they wish. If that is possible elsewhere, why is it not possible in this region? And to end on a pessimistic note, perhaps a perpetual state of semi-warfare is necessary for both Israel and the surrounding autocratic Arab states to maintain the present setup. Israel without the external threat could implode on its internal cleavages, which are very strong, and the anti-imperialist, anti-Israeli rhetoric are the main source of legitimacy for corrupt and authoritarian Arab regimes. And the irony is that this state, which was founded as the sanctuary of vulnerable, persecuted Jews all over the world, is now more threatened than the diaspora, which is a safe haven, and the relationship has almost been reversed. Is a solution possible? You cannot use South Africa to find a solution which you can impose. Many argue only the US can impose a solution and hope for that. That is waiting for Godot. On both sides, it is necessary to give up dreams. How do you do that? I would argue it is absolutely crucial not to increase the insecurity of the opponent, but to increase the security. In South Africa, that was possible because whites too considered the benefits of historic compromise as superior to civil war. Negotiations have to start while violence continues. It has to be unconditional negotiations, otherwise you give extremists a veto power. It is important for resistance to be organized. I think it is also important to use the law, the strategic use of law, which the law discourse in South Africa opened spaces and used the limited rights. And finally, Israel and the Palestinians too, at some stage, have to say sorry for the past. The Middle East is the only conflict in the world where neither side has ever demanded, to my knowledge, a truth commission, a truth and reconciliation commission, because both sides are convinced of their exclusive legitimacy. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the HSRC, LSE and CREFSA for inviting me to be here. It's a pleasure to respond to Heribert Adam, whose work as a South African social scientist, like other South African social scientists, I've been responding to Heribert's work for 20 years now. I've always found it lucid and challenging, even or especially when I totally disagree with him. I have no claims to give comparative insights on Israel-Palestine and the South African situations. My remarks this evening are coming as a South Africanist, and I don't totally disagree with Heribert, but I've got three comments that I'd like to make on mainly the South African content of his paper, and then one question. I did note, In thinking about and reading for this, Heribert, I did come across a little book that may have been produced after you've done the work for this, by Marwan Bishara, called Palestine Israel, Apartheid or Peace. And I think it's the fullest attempt so far to push that analogy through fairly seriously. My three questions for Heribert are, firstly, to do with his explanatory model of how the South African historic compromise came about. Secondly, an absence in his paper of any comparison between the popular uprisings in South Africa, either 1976 or 86-8, with the first and second intifadas, or perhaps I should say with the first intifada and the early stages of the second. And then thirdly, I want to touch on his treatment of the South Africa-Israeli analogy at the level of the state, the question of whether or not the Bantustan metaphor, Bantustan analogy, is valid. In the first of those, why did the apartheid state sit down at the negotiating table? Heribert quotes with approval. He says hers is the best account of the complex transition, Patty Waldmeyer. And you'll find the quote in full. I'm selecting from it. By the mid-1970s, Afrikaners had begun to recognize the impossibilities foisted upon them by apartheid. They were motivated by morality. Gently, almost imperceptibly, apartheid had begun to prick the Afrikaner conscience. I think this is largely baloney. By the mid-1970s, just let's take the year 73 to 76. The Afrikaner state had to cope in those years with the Durban strikes and that mobilization of labor unrest that Heribert referred to, with acute economic recession after the rise in oil price, with dramatic geopolitical transformation on its borders, the independence of the collapse of the Portuguese fascist regime, independence for Angola and Mozambique, and a secret report to Forster's government in August 1976, which said we can no longer afford to pay the bill for the war in Rhodesia. And finally, starting on June 16th in 1976, the Soweto Youth Uprising, which in important and complex ways broke the existing mold of South African politics. This was not gentle nor imperceptible, and had far more to do with the shift in the balance of forces, social, geopolitical, concerning legitimacy, than with, and I'm quoting Waldmeyer again, the disturbance of the spiritual comfort of the national psyche. So I think if one takes that through, and I haven't got time this evening to do it more fully, but I mean, I think your account of why and how negotiations happened needs further attention. It links directly with my second point, that absence in your paper of any reference, any comparative reference, to Soweto, the uprising of 76, or I think more importantly, the uprisings which ebbed and flowed from the end of 1985 through to 1988, that led to the imposition of successive states of emergency, that saw 113,000 South Africans detained without trial, 63,000 injured, and 11,000 deaths. That show similarity with the Intifada in the imbalance of forces, if you like, the stone thrower against the tank, the spontaneity, and the mass character of the mobilization that took place. And indeed, the ability of the security forces to repress or snuff out that kind of protest. I don't think the useful comparison is with guerrilla war versus suicide bombers, which is what your sixth passage encourages us to think about. I think that the other similarity between those popular uprisings is captured at the iconic level in that photograph that you've all seen, Hector Peterson, the first, what I think of as the Hector Peterson Pieta photograph, the first victim of the shooting on June the 16th, 1976, and that other image, repeated and repeated across the world, of Mohamed Dura, the 12-year-old, ineffectively shielded by his father from bullets by the IDF. I think Yaro Edward Said, saying that Palestinians have not at all understood the politics of non-violence, nor, and this is quoted by Herbert, nor grasp the immense diffusionary, insistent, and repetitive power of media images in this conflict. It leads me to an assessment made by Mubarak Amal and Abdul Saeed in Tikkun, American-based critical journal on Israeli-Palestine relations, February this year. They said, at present, the Israelis cannot lose militarily, yet they cannot win politically. And Herbert, that will remind you, as it does me, of Harold Welpe and other people writing in about 1988-1990 about the South African situation. Harold Welpe said, we've reached a state of unstable equilibrium, where the state has reimposed a kind of shaky peace, a gun barrel, but cannot win legitimacy. Popular forces have shown ability to mobilize large numbers, but cannot dent the power of the security, forces. And I wonder whether that isn't a comparative avenue worth exploring. This disjuncture between armed force on the one hand and then a crisis of legitimacy on the other. You mention but don't develop that treason of the clerics in the South African case, the defection by Afrikaner intelligentsia. I'd say not only Afrikaner, the successive waves of students, editors, businessmen, academics and others who flew out of Cape Town and Johannesburg to Dakar and Lusaka and London to meet with the ANC. And I would like to know more about the analogous kinds of things happening between groups of intellectuals in Israel and Palestine, things that I only know of at second and third hand. I've been asked to restrict this to 8 minutes, so 30 more seconds on another, on my third critical point. Heribert makes the point that the Bantustan analogy isn't a very useful one. I actually agree with him. I think that's the wrong point of comparison. The Bantustans were these rural, distant dumping grounds for what the state calls surplus people. The far better analogy, I think, is with the rest of South Africa, the 87% of white South Africa, where a majority of Africans lived and were subject to physical segregation, tight controls over their movement and employment, were politically rightless, subject to curfews, had no rights to own land. There, I think, the comparison fairly leaps out at one for the occupied territories. As the Palestinian scholar Mohammed Halaj put it, writing last year, the settlements in the occupied territories serve as instruments of the apartheid system. That's not what I want to find. It was another scholar, Hisham Sharabi, said that Rabin's formula was based on a streamlined version of the South African Bantustan model, limited self-government in a kind of fictional state, but Netanyahu's plan was based on an antiquated apartheid model with no vestige of statehood. And I found that very suggestive, that what we're really harking back here to was a kind of high noon of apartheid, segregation plus authoritarianism. My final one-sentence question, that passage, it's your pages 28 to about 31, is so compelling on the difference in the two cases of external intervention, that huge, what you call the bankrolling by the United States of the Israeli state, that it left me wondering, that passage did, whether this is actually an exercise in comparative sociology or whether that's trumped by the exercise in comparative international relations.
So before heading over to our second discussant, I just wanted to do something I omitted to do at the beginning. And that is to thank Dr. James in particular, but also the HSRC, the Human Sciences Resource Council, who have very generously sponsored this evening.
Thank you very much. If I can just make five very brief points. The first being that change in South Africa was not easily predictable. And in fact, in the 1980s, it was not predictable at all. And what made the difference was the fall of Soviet-style communism in Eastern Europe, and which was seen to weaken the African National Congress. at the time, and it provided a moment, a rather special moment, for the people wielding power in South Africa under apartheid to maximize their interests under circumstances where the ANC's place in the struggle was seen as to be as weaker, as the first point. A second point, which is really to emphasize the points made by Professor Adam, that what made a special difference in South Africa, which in terms of the metaphor of the miracle is somewhat misleading and better described by an analysis of the ethos, having to do with political will and the capacity to mobilize political will, and having to do with the framing of a vision and mobilizing constituencies around that vision. And that the two personalities that were quite key in this was F.W. de Klerk on the one hand and Nelson Mandela on the other hand. And that Mandela became much more important during the democracy phase and F.W. de Klerk less important as the landscape changed. But these two personalities, and I don't wish to reduce it to these two personalities, but that their place in the changing landscape was absolutely crucial to what happened in South Africa, because they commanded a moral authority to hold their constituencies together in a process of change that in fact was unpredictable and was accompanied by high levels of violence. And in doing so, they were able to keep in check their detractors, they were able to keep in check sectarianism of various kinds, both within and outside of their respective political alliances. A third point, which I'd like to, in fact, just dwell on the particular role of Nelson Mandela in the changes before and after 1994. And he is obviously quite a complex personality, having gone through some extraordinary political experiences of a kind that cannot be matched easily by anybody else. But for him to emerge from that experience without much bitterness, but also quite a profound understanding of the integrity and the dignity of his opponent. To the point where, on an intellectual level, a willingness and a desire and a creation of a vehicle whereby there was an intellectual understanding of what it meant to be Afrikaner and what it meant to have an Afrikaans history that is a history not simply of the rise of white superiority. He's mastering the capacity to read Afrikaans, both Afrikaans literature and Afrikaans in a variety of other forms, and also the willingness to digest the writing in a way where there's an effort to develop an ethos of reciprocal altruism in the quest of various peoples to in fact live in harmony and peace and justice with one another. But to say that the political personality of a Mandela was absolutely central to both the way in which the South African settlement came about and how the first 5 years of democracy in South Africa became consolidated. A fourth point, which is really to speak also by way of extrapolating from Professor Adams' paper to understand the limitations of the South African settlement, in which land has become a problem. It's not of the same magnitude of Zimbabwe by any means, but where the lesson is about the costs of not implementing a land reform program at a pace and with a level of acceleration that in fact would contain a rural people. Firstly, land might become a problem. Ethnic assertion in South Africa comes and it goes, depending on the circumstances. So the assertion of an Inkatha or of a Zulu ethnicity. There is the politics of alignment between the South African Muslim community, which is part of the overall colored community, to pan-Arab issues, which complicates South African politics, not in a major way, but in a way that we should not ignore. And to say that in terms of the limitations of the South African settlement is that the South African government, ironically, inherited an infrastructure at a time of accelerating globalization, and therefore it lost the instruments to actually deal with some of the key questions that face the South African people presently, and particularly in terms of poverty alleviation. There's also the AIDS question, which is a different issue altogether, but where there's also a lack of a vehicle to deal with AIDS and HIV infection, which tears at our social fabric on a fairly daily basis. And finally, really just to say, I suppose by quoting Oscar Wilde, when asked the question, what is a nation? He said, a nation is a bunch of people living in one place. And that in some senses, it is as simple as that. And that if there is the will and the capacity within Israel and Palestine to create an environment where people can just live in one place, it is something that, if nothing else, is the hope that in part comes from reading into the very interesting narrative that Professor Adam gave about a South African people who actually summoned the wall under the right set of circumstances to find a place and an environment in which they can coexist in peace and justice. Thank you.
We're now, all the speakers are prepared to take questions now, so I'd like to throw the floor open for questions. Anybody, please, there are roving microphones, so if you could just raise your hand and the microphone should reach you.
Yeah, thank you, Professor Adam, for your lecture. I don't quite know exactly where to start, but I'll try anyway. Maybe I'll start from some inaccuracies that you asked with regards to polls about expulsion. I'm not gonna.
Okay. Set a please keep it story. Brief. You don't give many people a chance to discuss.
Yeah, I'm not gonna give a speech. But actually, there are many polls that are suggesting that over 75% of Israeli population are for a Palestinian state. Basically, what I'm trying to say, there's a lot of confusion about poll and within Israeli society. This is fluctuating quite a bit. So I think, just for the sake of academic rigor, I would be quite reserved of kind of showing one poll as the determining factor. Basically, I think just three quick points. First point, I think it would be easier for us in an academic institution if you would just set your analytical paradigm and say that you are comparing between two apartheid societies. I think the fact that this panel hasn't got any expert, most expertise here are about South Africa, and you kind of glossed it through, I think it would have been easier for us saying, listen, I think there are two apartheid societies, and then make the comparison, because your different innuendos between secret meetings, Israeli generals and South Africans, Herder over Kant, et cetera, kind of give the impression to the objective listener that you're actually alluding to this, but it's much easier to give the name. We're talking about divided societies. So if you are talking about apartheid societies, it would be, I think, more dignified towards your audience to address it in your talk. Secondly, I think it's slightly out of historical perspective. I think you completely overglossed the negotiation culminating in Camp David. According to historian Oxford Avi Schleim, actually there was a proposal to try to put an end to the Middle East conflict, which was rejected by the Palestinians, and you kind of glossed over as if this is a very kind of osmotic process, and I think you should have addressed that too. And that goes also with regards to the uninterest that the Israeli left has. Actually, the historian revisionists all came from the Israeli left, who actually questioned what happened in 1948. Benny Morris, Ilan Pape, they all came from the Israeli left, and they were very curious to know what really happened in 1948. Finally, I think there is some very profound misunderstanding from your part, especially with regards to your utopian desired solution. I'm not an expert on South Africa. I know very little about it. I'm probably close to being ignorant about South Africa. However, when I look around the Middle East, I see democracy trying to be imposed in Lebanon, which collapsed into a civil war. I see Algeria that collapsed into a civil war. And there is a lot of growing literature about attempts to put certain regions in the world into transition to democracy, which actually promoted and exacerbated ethnic conflict. And I think you had, at least after expressing this utopian and desired conflict, you had to defend it much more profoundly, unless you actually, at least in the Middle Eastern context, which I'm sure you're not, suggesting that Israel / Palestine would turn into such a conflict. So, I just that's my three conclusions, and in short, I think it was a very, very one-sided. Not that I'm a supporter of any of the policies constructed by Israel, but I think for the sake of academic rigor in an institution such as the LSE, a much more balanced, or at least accurate analytically, lecture should have been requested from you, especially with regards to the title. Just tell us, two apartheid societies, let's get on with it.
Thank you very much. Someone in the front and then someone there towards the back. Someone.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think it's wrong to talk about two apartheid societies. I think it may have been true in the 1980s. But I think what the previous contributor missed, and also I think was maybe missing from the introduction, was the incredible impact of the peace process on Israel over the past 10 years. I mean, perhaps because of a lack of time, but in the introduction, the assumption seemed to be that the conflict in the Middle East was primarily driven between Israel and the Palestinians, with some kind of internally driven dynamic to the conflict. Whereas, as far as I can see, as someone whose family come from the region, and I've spent a lot of time both in Palestinian refugee camps and Israeli settlements, the West and external forces have a large share of the blame, and the so-called peace process has played a large part in making the conflict a lot worse. And if you want to just take a couple of examples, just to show what I mean, take the most horrific example imaginable you can think of. Take suicide bombings. Try and think of what they're about from a political perspective, beyond the murders of individuals and the twisted metal that you see. What's going on there politically? As far as I can see, as far as the Palestinian leadership is concerned, why they're sponsoring suicide bombings is because they're trying to internationalize the conflict. They're trying to get recognition from the West. They're trying to get the West to intervene and put pressure on Israel. So to some extent, you can see that as a consequence of Western intervention. You can see a similar thing on the Israeli side. You can see...
Sorry, could you keep it brief and come
to
the question?
I'm giving two examples. This is my second example, then I'm concluding. If you look at the Israeli side, you have Operation Protective Wall or Defensive Wall, however you want to translate it. And what that is about is Israel saying, yes, we're like the West. The West has got a campaign against terror in Iraq. We've got our campaign against terror against the Palestinians. So what I'm really saying is very simple, that the West and the Western peace process has played a very large part in exacerbating the conflict. It's not all internally generated.
Thank you. One here in the back, and I'd like to take one on top too. Okay, just a minute. There's first a woman here in the back and then come to the top.
I can only speak of the Western Cape, but negative consequences of transformation have been the rise of a different kind of power, where communities are dominated and in fact controlled by gangs and gang behavior. Colored friends of mine hold the opinion that they'd rather live under apartheid, where the locus of control was explicit government doctrine rather than their violent neighborhoods. And they would rather live in a city famous for its apartheid regime than its murder and rape statistics. Would a peace process in Israel simply shift aggression and violent conflict into a different arena and therefore be a superficial peace where people still live in fear? Atrocities are going on now in the Cape Flats, where I've been working for the past year, and the horror of those atrocities often surpass anything during apartheid. Yet South Africa is still talked of as being in a state of peace.
Thank you. I'll take one more question and turn to our panel. There's a woman here at the top. Please.
I'd like to concentrate on the positive sides, positive points which you have illustrated. First of all, I would like to say that both parties definitely have reached to they are in a circle of violence which is not serving anybody's purpose except killing more people on both sides. So there, and I definitely believe that it is the failure of both leaderships, not only the Israelis, neither the Palestinians. Both of them have contributed to this extra violence because of lack of vision and lack of strategic intentions, really, to end the conflict. Perhaps much more clearer on Sharon's side, while Arafat at the moment is trying to do everything. The other necessary point to acknowledge is that both societies must, you have mentioned something about they must say sorry. But I would say that both of them have to come out of the denial state of each other's suffering. What I would like to ask your opinion is two things. How we can increase the Israeli security, okay, to make them really realize that they will not have any security without a true, just solution based on two states and not to, because even if a transfer happens, it's not going to end the conflict. It's going to, in fact, take it to many more suffering in the next many years. And the other point is,
Okay. So given the time, I think I'd like to take one more question from the top and then let the panelists conclude because we're coming close to 7:30. The gentleman here with the green jacket here. Yep, you.
No statement, just two very brief questions. I thought Dr. James's question on whether comparative international relations trumps comparative sociology is a very good one, and would really like to hear an answer on that one. And the other one is regarding demographics and whether or not you thought the difference in identities between the South African civic bond, such small as it was, but that it seemed, you suggested that it did exist, versus Israel-Palestine, where it doesn't. That if in Israel-Palestine the demographics became such that even under circumstances as they are, the Arab population is growing much faster, that even if one day the Arab population was approaching the South African ratio, even then you wouldn't have the same kind of accommodation because of the difference in identities.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you. All of the speakers here have been, I think, too much emphatic on the differences in the two situations. If I may, could you briefly tell us three key lessons from the South African situation which would be directly applicable in the resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli impasse? Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much for the questions. I'm sorry we don't have more time for that. But before handing over, and I'd like just to turn to each of our speakers in turn to respond to all of the questions or those of which that they feel in a position to respond. I wonder if I could abuse my position as chair just to add one small rider to the questions that asked that sort of runs through some of those, and that is the question of boundaries and how important that is in this whole debate in terms of who you define as being inside versus outside in any particular decision context. But if I could perhaps it's best to turn to discussions first, and we'll leave the last word to our main speaker, Professor Bundy.
I'd really just like to respond to the gentleman who spoke about Riga and the comparative method. I don't know if he's had a chance to read Herbert Adams' paper. I have, and I actually think the imputation of the lack of Riga is unfair. I think the comparative basis is set out very, very clearly. I think it's helpful for thinking, the six categories that were chosen. And even if one disagrees with the use to which they put, I think that the apparatus for the comparative exercise is scrupulously laid out and made clear. So you needn't answer that bit.
Sorry, Professor, could you respond to the comparative international relations?
I'm not sure if you wanted me to reply to that, the comparative international relations or...
No, I think it's a very bad question. Why do you want to distinguish disciplinary compartments? We are an interdisciplinary approach is much better. I don't give a damn whether this is in international relations or comparative sociology. What does it matter as long as you gain insights?
Let me... As a committed cross-disciplinary and cross-regional enthusiast coming from SOAS, let me put the other side of that. What I was asking was, given the extreme difference in the circumstances of the South African and the Israeli-Palestine case for third-party intervention, whether that aspect of a six-fold analytical framework didn't have the effect of making the of one equaling more than the five other. So it's not really asking you to opt for one discipline rather than another. It's asking whether in the balance of forces at play at the moment, that international set of considerations, the question of oil, the strategic, the historic links, don't outweigh some of the other comparative points.
Dr. Gange.
On the question of whether life is better under democracy rather than apartheid, in the Western Cape. Just to say that apartheid was a moral question, it was a human rights question, and it was a justice question. And the fact that the democratic order introduced core values around justice and human rights and just common human decency in the way in which the political order was set up and governed through a constitution is far preferable in terms of a political arrangement and far preferable in terms of creating broader social stability. But yes, there's crime, and there's enormous crime in the Western Cape, and South Africans are trying to deal with that, and we're struggling. So, I mean, that's all really I have to say, rather than make a comparison as to whether life now is better under democracy or under apartheid. I think it's important to say, when asked the question, what is the most directly relevant issues that South Africa can offer? I mean, with great modesty and humility, given that the Middle Eastern question is a different one, as Professor Adam tried very, very usefully to highlight, so that we don't have a superficial understanding of the comparison, is to say that there's a very elementary principle that makes it possible for human beings to in fact find solutions, and that is to actually recognize what is wrong and what is harmful, and in that process recognize the dignity of the coexistence of human beings. And that becomes, as a value and as a social practice, becomes a very important part of actually finding ways of having peaceful coexistence between people. So so those would be my only comments. Thanks.
I like to address particularly the first speaker. I partly agree with you that democracy in the Arab states, or long overdue democratization of Arab states, may actually make things worse. We have to only think about Algeria. If democratization means that fundamentalists take power, in other words, if the popular masses are indoctrinated by the mosques in fundamentalism, and this expresses itself in the vote, I'm not sure whether that would lead to a peaceful settlement. It may actually lead to more polarization. I don't have an answer to that. I don't think the military government, which annulled elections in Algeria, is the answer, but nor is necessarily the naive belief in democratization the only route to go. You started off by saying, I should have said, these are two apartheid societies and let's compare it. That would have fed into this sort of facile, dangerous analogies which I tried to not to use. Maybe in some respects in Israel it's worse than apartheid. At least apartheid tried to use a Bantu stance for subsidized the Bantustan, while in Israel the current government actually destroys the social fabric of Palestinian society and wants to totally actually eliminate what is left there of Palestinian identity and autonomy. Apartheid had different motives. Apartheid, I mean, we can go, this is a long history. I think it is, to just say these are two different apartheid societies is, I think, not adequate. About a fifth of this booklet is devoted to Camp David, which you said is missing, and the Oslo process. And you say it was rejected by the Palestinians. This is now the conventional wisdom. I think all three parties in Camp David made crucial mistake. The Palestinians, Americans, Barak, all are responsible. Actually, Camp David was improved considerably 6 months later in Taba, and the Palestinians and the Israelis were very close or have never been in a common statement, they say so, as close on the issues of settlement, Jerusalem, return of refugees, as they were at Taba. But then Sharon got into power and he made it worse. 70% of the Israeli population still hopes for land for peace deal. And you are quite right, or someone else said, security is a crucial issue. And clearly Palestinian actions in the Second Intifada haven't contributed to a sense of Israeli security, which has actually marginalized the peace movement and destroyed it. Insofar, you are quite right. What is different is, you mentioned Ilan Pappa and Benny Morris. In South Africa, many Afrikaner social scientists with any intelligence defected from the ruling party over the 5 years in the mid-80s. In Israel, if you use Benny Morris as an example, you have almost the reverse move, that post-Zionists actually have almost joined up with the Benny Morris has now renounced his earlier writing and that it was a mistake and it is all Arafat's fault. So that's crucial. The peace process made it worse, exacerbated? No, I don't think that's, you can say that. Sharon made it worse, and whenever there was a hope for some kind of truce, Sharon, who benefits from having actually an extremist Palestinian leadership, reinforced this kind of extremism on the other side. That's, if you ask yourself, what is in Likud's, in Sharon's interest? Is it an accommodating, moderate Palestinian leadership, or is it a fanatical extremist leadership? And I think the answer is quite clear. In South Africa, that was a third point, both leaderships, and this is very important, assisted each other. Mandela came to the help of de Klerk when the townships were on the verge of exploding after Hani was assassinated on Easter 93. And vice versa, both sides had an interest in accommodation, and that helped the transfer of power. The three lessons from South Africa: start negotiating even during violent periods. In South Africa, bombs went off until April, the day of the elections, and yet it didn't stop the transfer process. Address each other. The opponent must also be convinced. And I can draw other lessons. But let me just briefly perhaps say a few words about the comments by my panelist here. I agree with Colin. I didn't really pay enough attention to the uprisings, to the instability, the stalemate which these uprisings caused. The Pretoria government couldn't pacify the townships, and the townships couldn't defeat the Pretoria government. That was clear. Once both sides realized there is a stalemate, then they started to seek alternative solutions. But where I don't agree with Colin is, I think the moral erosion of Afrikanerdom, the idea that you have to rule with justice, the sort of Van Wyk Lowe idea that a people who rule without justice lose their soul, that was an important contributor. That wasn't the only triggering cause. The real trigger was the end of the Cold War, that they quite rationally calculated. The ANC is weak without Soviet support. If the Cubans and the Soviets had supported the ANC, de Klerk wouldn't have gotten 69% mandate for negotiation. Nothing was inevitable. If the Conservatives had been in power, it would have taken a long time to get there. Actually, Colin, the insurrection was defeated by 88. It wasn't, I mean, defeated in the sense that it wasn't, I mean, the emergencies in a way had worked, had at least temporarily sort of stabilized the situation. And but I agree, I should have paid much more attention to that instability. Yeah, we have Wilmot quite rightly emphasized the personalities of leadership, as I said, and the land question. And in South Africa, we really, it's not solved yet. It's ongoing. The inequality between black and white has narrowed, but the inequality within each group has widened. The groups are not reconciled yet, and probably never will be, and the legacy of that terrible past is with us. So it's not a solution which can be peddled and sold like some people say the Truth Commission is, and the memory industry is the answer to all problems.
Thank you very much. Just a couple of words by way of wrap-up. First, to repeat the invitation I made at the beginning for all of you, or those of you who can, to join us for a reception now on the fifth floor of this building in the senior dining room. Secondly, I wanted to thank Gabriella Lombardo, the executive officer to the director, and Adrian Headland of the HSRC in South Africa for the organization that made this event possible. Thanks. And finally, I hope you all join me in thanking the panelists tonight.